Sound check. Today's date is March 7th, 2019. The interview team is myself, Jack Jaswali, and John Walker. And the interviewee is Julia Maxton. So where and when were you born?
I was born here in Dayton, Ohio in 1940, and I lived here until I went to Miami. And then I lived in Europe in northern France until 1965, which was 6 years.
And what were your parents' names?
Hilda and Clifford Kirtner. My dad was a very successful attorney in downtown Dayton and set up the Allwood Reserve and Park Farm and a lot of other historical sites around town.
And do you have any siblings?
No.
So what is your best memory from childhood?
Going downtown. It was a fun place. I would get on the bus. I went to Brown School, and I would get on the bus on Fridays and ride downtown, meet my dad at his office. We'd walk over to the arcade and have our dinner and pick up a pint of fresh oysters for my mother and take them home because that was the day she cleaned house and she didn't want us underfoot.
So what elementary school did you go to?
E.J. Brown, which was, we were kind of considered, we were all along the Miami River, and there was a lot of grade schools, and once you graduated from Los or E.J. Brown, then you moved on to Colonel White and Fairview. I actually was in a transition period, so I only went to Colonel White 1 year, and then I graduated. I went to Fairview for 3.
So, you said you went to Miami after high school.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you live there or did you commute?
No, we had to live there, lived in dorms. And back in that particular period of time, a campus was just enlarging, and they didn't allow any vehicles at all. So, everybody lost a lot of weight because you walked a long distance from the natatorium down to the quads where the girls' dorms were. And there wasn't really any business major then. Elementary education and or liberal arts or that sort of thing. So I kind of pieced together my education, and it was great because I got to take a lot of really cool different topics, and I graduated with a liberal arts degree.
Are you married?
Not anymore.
Do you have any children?
I have two girls that are grown and gone.
Any grandkids?
Nope.
So what do you do for a living?
I'm the president of the South Metro Regional Chamber of Commerce, which is a business advocacy group for 7 of the communities here south of Dayton. My offices are located in Washington Township, but I represent West Carrollton, Miamisburg, a bit of Springboro, Miami Township, Washington Township, Centerville, a bit of Sugar Creek, a bit of Clear Creek, and a little bit of Bellbrook.
And what do you like to do in your spare time? Do you have any hobbies?
I have horses, and particularly Frisian horses, which I show and thoroughly enjoy. Sometimes I'll have saddlebreds, and oftentimes I'll have hackneys.
So what was dating like when you were younger?
Well, the base was thriving. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was thriving. And downtown was the hub of the area. It was where all the corporate headquarters were located, all of the arts. And back in the day, there were movie theaters, there was theater, there were concerts. Everything was dressed for dinner, very elegant, white tie kind of things. There were a lot of hotels in downtown. And so people would come, you know, for special occasions. There were a lot of department stores. The ladies came downtown to get their hair done. All of your clothing was purchased downtown. There were trolleys that ran through the middle of town. There was canoe clubs on the river. There were concerts on the river. Very, very different than it is today. In a way, you know, with all the electronics and the way we live now so quickly, we're a little more isolated than you were back then. You know, I came up in a generation where your grandfather would take you downtown and buy you a soda at Maud Miller's, and then you'd go to the movies, you know, and go to the arcade and take something home to your mom for dinner or whatever. They had great peanut butter in the arcade.
You were involved in the revitalization efforts. I knew specifically about the 2000s attempt, but not so much about the 1980s attempt that you were involved in. So mm-hmm. You just allow me to gather my thoughts for a minute. So. I suppose my first question would be, at what time throughout the 1970s did the arcade close the first time and thus make it necessary for you to lead your first effort to bring it back?
The arcade actually never closed. Parts of it closed. Okay. When it opened in the mid-1900s, it was really the first indoor shopping mall in the country, probably. And there were a lot of specialty shops in there, a lot of food shops. And parts of it stayed open all the way through. When we took it over, it was privately owned. It was a private sector project, and we started. I was hired in 1973 by a local realtor company who actually owned the major portion of it, and the perimeter that faced out on 3rd Street and Main Street and Ludlow Street and those kind of things. There were shops that were considered part of the arcade. They had a pass-through, but most of those had been closed. So you entered off of the outside streets and did your shopping and went on. When we got a hold of it, and I was hired because I was local, and I was hired for $12,000 a year. That was my salary. And that was good for that time, actually. We hadn't even conceptualized it yet. We just knew that it was gorgeous when you went inside. People hadn't seen it for years, the interior. And so as this whole concept opened up, then the local real estate people formed what they called the management committee that was made up of corporate money. We needed the money. And so we had the Meads and the NCRs and the Dacos and all the major businesses who had corporate headquarters in Dayton to form what was called the management committee that made the decisions on how to spend the money and how to contrive the money. Because the corporations wanted their corporate headquarter town to be absolutely a gem. And so this was going to be the heart of Dayton, and was the heart of Dayton. And was then all the construction was, am I on?
Yeah.
Oh. When it got to be such a magnificent project, the management committee decided it was more than they could handle. So they interviewed companies all over the country that were at that time rehabbing downtown Pittsburgh, downtown New York City, so on and so forth. And they hired a company called Halcyon Limited from Hartford, Connecticut, who in turn hired me, the local girl, to give them the insight into, you know, the community and introduce them to community leaders. There was no public funds involved at this time. We had $22 million to start with, and what we did was we had a team of architects that came in. They traveled. We had apartments here in town, and the architects would come in and draw up conceptions. The marketing people would come in and do plans, and how they morphed this whole project, began to acquire the other outside buildings until we owned most of the block. And then we began looking for tenants. And then I was on the road all week long with my associate realtors. I got my real estate license. And we brought in, like, Spaghetti Warehouse, who we had to put at Fifth Street because we couldn't fit them in the basement, because you had to do the trolley car. You know, there were all kinds of things. But we had the whole property filled with companies from out of the city.
So would you say that the reason why you joined that project was out of love for the arcade and wanting to see it back, or was it out of like a good business opportunity?
I didn't look at it as a business opportunity. It was just so cool and so beautiful. And I've always been one of these visionaries. I've always had odd jobs that nobody else could, you know, handle particularly. And it was so satisfying. It was watching a cathedral open up, because you have to remember that all of the glass in there, all of the roof in the Third Street Arcade and in the Rotunda had been tarred over and covered with sheeting because of the blackouts during the bombing of the Second World War. So as we peeled all that back and we discovered behind false walls and everything else, all that fruit and all those cornucopias and all that beautiful molding is tin, and it was all hand-painted, and nobody knew all that was under there. And as we kept discovering the original folding doors in the archways in the rotunda and down in the basement, all kinds of cool stuff, it was just, you couldn't stop. It was addicting. You couldn't wait till you get there the next day and discover something else. It's very exciting.
So while discovering stuff then, did it bring back any memories you had as a kid or when you were younger?
Oh, sure, because like I said, they had great food. They had wonderful peanut butter. And my dad and I always went there every Friday night for dinner. There were some exciting things. Like I said, the building was broken up into four sections. There was an alley that ran between the Third Street section and the main rotunda building. And we had no idea, we found this enormous elevator that farmers would drive the team and horses onto the elevator. It was rope operated, take them down to the basement where the artesian wells pumped ice cold water into cubicles that were used for refrigeration. Nobody knew that was down there. Everybody that knew that was dead. Another neat thing that we found, another elevator story, but one of the merchants in there had this little cramped office that you would have to go in and meet with him, is Walker's American Way. And Mr. Walker was big enough for a desk. So when it came time to tear it out, because it was right in the middle of the rotunda, it too was an elevator, but it was a brass birdcage elevator that had been stopped on the mid-floor. He didn't even know it was an elevator because it had ugly paneling on the inside of it, and you couldn't see all this filigree and all this fretwork that was all around this beautiful elevator. So a lot of those things, you know, people bought them, and, you know, they're long gone. They didn't stay with the building.
So the apartments in the arcade, did you ever live in them?
No, I did not. They were occupied mostly by the smart little ladies that worked in all of the dress departments and all the downtown department stores. And back then, they had to wear dark hose, dark heels. They could only wear brown, black, or navy dresses with a lace handkerchief in their pocket with a pin on it. And they all lived right across the street from where they worked in the arcade. There were 40 apartments. They're still there with marble fireplaces, clawfoot tubs. They were nice little 2 and 3 bedroom apartments, but everybody had to move out for us to do the construction, and then we lost occupancy. And that was when we got into a lot of financial trouble, because to meet code, stairwells weren't wide enough, sprinklers weren't adequate, the buildings were different heights, so there weren't floors that were consistent, and that's when everything changed.
So talking about those changes, like, what significant changes of the arcade did you see happen from when you were a kid to as you got older?
Well, it looked better. It was clean. It was refreshed. And everything that was in there, as far as retail, was current. So you could go in there to Casual Corner and buy clothes. You could go into Overby's Emporium and take a cooking lesson and buy a fine bottle of wine. We had excellent restaurants. And then my job, besides having the merchants group and everything, I did all the entertainment. And this was before they cut out the rotunda floor, and we had all the bistro tables and plants down there. And you could come in the evening and get a glass of wine and have, you know, an orchestra play. Or at Christmas time, we had Tucky Monroe from the Dayton Opera singing Ave Maria down on the main floor, you know, in the evening. There was always something beautiful going on. And one of my favorite events was the Victoria Theater had a Groucho Marx Festival, and it was black tie. And they wanted to have their after the theater dinner in the arcade, and everyone was in long dresses and black tie, and they all had the glasses with the big nose, which was reminiscent of Groucho Marx, of those of you who remember. And they all got a pair of those, and here they come walking down Main Street, arms linked in these beautiful gowns and black ties, you know, everything with these big noses and glasses on, came in the arcade. They had a dance band, and they just had a ball. It was just beautiful.
So do you have any bad memories of the arcade?
No, not really. A lot of people were concerned because downtown Dayton was kind of empty and kind of not much going on. It was a corporate center and a business center, but it sort of shut down at 5 o'clock. And that was part of the idea, was to get the T&E crowd to stay in the hotels. We had a convention center we put in. We put in the Oregon District bars. We converted the wide MCA on the river into condos. We wanted residential. So the bad part was it was empty. The good part was we decided that you replace the emptiness with more interested people. And so it became a very safe place to be. We had no problem with panhandling at that time, or, you know, street people or anything like that. The worst thing we might have is a guy sitting on the street corner selling roses at midnight out of a bucket.
So, you already mentioned how in the early stages when you were involved by the mid-70s, it was a private financed venture. So, I was curious, very curious, as to when public government funding began to enter the picture and how that affected the overall development, whether private investors based their financial support on the availability of public money, and just where that took the project.
Well, a couple things happened all at the same time. In the early 80s, there was a huge financial slump, and we had almost every street corner in downtown Dayton at that time was occupied by a very successful bank. A lot of banks that are long gone. At the same time, because of cost overruns, as anybody who watches HGTV knows, you know, you start tearing out walls and you find all kinds of bad surprises. So our $22 million that we had put aside to complete the arcade ran out, and there was absolutely no other way to come up with any funding. So we had to go to public money. There was HUD money, there was the City of Dayton money, and that was really used and really was only allowed because it was used for public walkways, the escalators, the elevators, anything that involved transportation of the public. That was justifiable. And so that also changed then the security situation in the arcade and everything else, because it was public. And so where before, when the evening was done and the shops were closed and the building would be closed down for security reasons, and there's a lot of entrances and exits in and out of that building because it covers a whole city block, it had to be all left open. And that was when we started. This was the late 70s and early 80s, and that's when we started to have some issues. And that was when the tenants in there were paying at least $22 a square foot plus a common area on top of that that was very, very high. So if you had a small 380-square-foot floral shop, and now the guy on the corner with the bucket of roses could come in the arcade because it was wintertime, and he would sit in front of your shop and sell his roses out of his bucket, which was what happened, then the whole climate changed. And they, in order also to make the numbers work, that was when they cut the floor out of the rotunda. And that was what broke my heart, because we lost our public park. We lost our place where you could come and relax and have a cup of coffee and enjoy a beautiful, beautiful space. Sunlight 24/7, you know, kind of a place. In fact, one of my themes was play, shop, and dine 24 hours anytime, you know, because it was always there. But it did cause some other problems. And I left in 82. And that was kind of why.
So the big thing, what you mentioned about what broke your heart, you think that was the biggest change about the arcade that was for the worst?
The two things that upset me the most were the decisions on the tenant space, you know, who we leased to, was decided by the management committee, which had expanded by then. And I actually had myself a deal with PBS, Channel 14 and 16, This was before they had moved in under the transportation center where they are now. They were looking to expand. And we had a tentative lease agreement with them to put them in the rotunda. They would have occupied the third floor. All those big arched doorways all the way around would have been their offices. And they also would have had use of the now open lower level when they cut out the rotunda floor. It was a perfect use. And it would have helped the arcade in a lot of ways with its brand, and it would have been a beautiful location for them. That lease approval was never made. And then the other thing was when the rotunda floor was cut out. I understand they needed to open up the basement to have more leasable space. They never were able to lease it because it was a basement. And so it just changed the whole wonderful atmosphere of the place.
So, another one of my questions would be, aside from the arcade, what other urban development or revitalization projects were you involved in? How did they attempt to shape the downtown into a sort of social and cultural space? And what were any negative developments that hindered, you know, the development or redevelopment of downtown Dayton?
Well, a lot of the resulting development, we had several new hotels put in. On the back corner of the arcade at 4th and Ludlow was a small boutique hotel that a family in Dayton called the Graubarths bought and turned into a very elegant, small, fine dining restaurant and hotel called the Daytonian. The plaza between the convention center and 4th Street was empty at that time. And when I founded the International Festival of World Affairs, we used to use that as part of the festival. Well, then Stouffer Hotel came in and built one of their flagship hotels there because of the arcade and the ensuing T&E business. Actually had a lot to do with the development of the Oregon District and all the bars and all the fun that went on down there. We converted properties into condominiums. We were the first, and we being the team with the arcade and the management committee, to focus on the river. We looked at even at one point rerouting the downtown so that it was more pedestrian friendly, because we used to block off streets and have running races downtown. The one that I ran was called Freeze Your Buns Run, and it was in March. We had Gymkhanas with sports cars driving through downtown. We tried to make it much more of a gathering place in total. And the negative things that happened was the financial crisis in the early 80s, when a lot of money just wasn't available anymore. And there was a lot of retail in downtown that went away. Some of the downtown department stores closed. And then the big, really final blow was I-675. There were a lot of people in downtown Dayton that were against it, that fought it tooth and nail. There was a public figure named Pat Roach that pushed it very hard, and a lot of people predicted what would happen, which did happen, was it developed the suburbs and took the last breath of retail out of downtown Dayton. And some people, you know, disagree with that, some people agree with that, but that was actually what happened.
So do you think that was like a major blow on the arcade, the building of I-675?
It didn't help. It was a pretty tough thing to get around.
So after the arcade closed down, what were some of the constraints that started to form in downtown Dayton?
Well, of course, the economy was still bad. And then I think the other thing that needed to be considered was that for various reasons, the business population left downtown. As the suburbs opened up, there were areas that were newer and fresher and, you know, build a suit and all that sort of thing. And so the population, which went from 40, 45,000 folks around that central area, were gone. And I always have said that if it hadn't been for really the courts and law and finance, a lot of finance businesses are still down there, and county and city government, there would not be too many people left. So this new surge, you know, with all these people that are trying to make downtown come back, you know, the amenities are there. They just have to find a way. And you have some major corporations like CareSource and things that are pledging and bringing people back. But even those people, you know, don't have all the restaurants to run and get a nice lunch and all the things that used to be there. So it's going to be a process. But I think the good thing is that it's been identified. And you've got the focal point of the river and, you know, you've got the Schuster and you've got some great things going on. So it just kind of went away for about 20 years, and these younger people are, I think, seeing the value of it.
And then what about the convention center? How do you think that affected downtown?
The day the convention center opened, the director, who was a friend of mine, George Demarest, said, you know, this place was never built to be what it needs to be. It's confined because of the overpass that runs behind it, and it's really too small. The ceilings are too low. There's no delivery zone in the back. And that's why with these low ceilings and size constraints, you don't see, there's no way that you could put in rodeos or car, you know, races or all the things that you see in other areas with their convention complexes. It's always been difficult. The floors were never sealed. There's a theater in there. A lot of people don't even know it's upstairs. It just was not big enough and not small enough. It was just kind of in between. It was built to fit. And when we were doing the arcade, we looked at taking the block across Main Street, the 6th Street block, tearing down the Ribold building, tearing down Stomp's Chevrolet building and all of that, and putting a huge living arts complex in there with a walk across, because the overpass already limits traffic height, to try to expand the usage of the arcade. Because now, you know, they have a hotel connected, they've got the transportation connected, they've got the Oregon District right there with people living there, and it would make all the sense in the world for T&E, you know, travel and expense business. But it just never was the right size.
So just to follow up with one last thing, where specifically in Dayton did you grow up and who were your neighbors?
I grew up on Deweese Parkway, which is on the Stillwater River just north of downtown. I learned to ice skate on the river at the Helena Bandshell right there at the... And the Dayton Canoe Club, I think the lockers might still be some of them over there by the Bandshell. My family were members of that. On my part of Deweese Parkway, there were only 5 homes. The first home at Siebenthaler was George Fox, who had Fox Cleaners. Some people might remember Pantorium Cleaners. The next house was Edgar Burns, and he had all the Gallagher drugstores, which were as commonplace as a CVS or a Walgreens. They were everywhere, locally owned. The next house was the Suttmiller family, who had the famous Supper Club. D. Dean Martin and the Rat Pack and everybody else came here to entertain in their supper club. Then my home, my dad was a lawyer. The next home next door was the Monticello replica, and that was Zerby Bradford, who invented, was part of Boss Kettering's gang and invented the Delco brake and the self-starter, electric starter. And the last house was George Pierce, who invented the microwave for Frigidaire.
So interesting. Thank you. What's up?
As a way to sort of lock down the timeline, I was hoping you could tell us when specifically you worked as part of the group, the management committee, and its affiliates that helped to redevelop the arcade.
I was recruited from the Dayton Convention Center. I had run a couple of events there and had founded the International Festival of World Affair there. And I was recruited away from that in 1974 and began. I was on the ground floor before we really even had a plan or the financing together. And the Fitzpatrick family basically were spearheading the project to look at some kind of investment and expansion. We knew not what. And I stayed there and worked on it, did the leasing, did the marketing, did the planning, traveled all over the country doing similar projects because we shared our expertise when we became Halcyon Limited all over the country. I worked in New York, Toledo, down in Florida, all over, Louis Armstrong Park, all these places, Pittsburgh, that had similar downtown projects. And I left in 1982, but I stayed downtown and worked for another company developing other projects that also lent itself to the core of the downtown market.
All right. And on behalf of all the partners in the Day in History Project, we'd like to thank you for allowing us to hear your story. And we'll be sharing this on the Day in History Project website in the near future.
Good. That's nice.
Thank you.